Welcome back, everybody, to Arthropod, your entomology podcast. I am one of your hosts, Jonathan Larson of the University of Nebraska.
And I am your other host, Jody Green, also from the University of Nebraska.
We're both wearing our red shirts today. We gave a talk a little bit ago about bed bugs.
Bed bug roadshow.
We've swiveled into our podcast mode, though, here this morning. I'm excited to talk with you, Jody. I love our chats. We both have coffee. We're in comfy chairs. Like, this is going to be good, right?
Yes. It's always awesome.
It's always a good time. And we're going to giggle a lot. And we're going to talk a lot about some insect folklore. That's the topic that we're going to do today. Before we get started, I did want to tell all of our listeners, if you haven't listened to some of our past episodes, we have some really cool content that we've put out in the last month or so. We've been really churning things out since Jody and Mike have joined the show. And we had a really fun time at ESA 2017 this year.
We went to Denver.
Mile High Entomology Podcast.
Yeah.
Coming at you from there. We put out three shows. What was the first one?
We talked to Sarah Triplett.
Of the Denver Butterfly Pavilion.
And you got to go there.
I did get to go there afterwards. Lucky. I took my family, my wife and daughter, to the Butterfly Pavilion. It was beautiful. My wife was like, are you sure you're not going to be bored at this? Don't you know, like, everything that they're going to try and teach you? And I said, I might, but I've never seen a zoo solely dedicated to invertebrates. There's like pavilions in zoos, but this is all on its own and it's all bugs all the time and other, you know, the other arthropods, the ones that we don't talk as much about. But they were all there and it was really fun. It was really interactive. When we went there, there were probably like six fourth grade classes kind of running around. And so you can feed off that energy, right? If you're around kids, they're getting into all the bugs and stuff. It was really awesome. If you get a chance to go, if you're ever in Denver, I would highly recommend it.
Yeah, I didn't get to go, but I'm going to go back to Denver with my daughter and do that. But an update for me is I did get a tarantula, and we named her Fangs. And she lived about 2 weeks, and she passed away on Thanksgiving. So I'm in the process of getting a new one, but I did everything that Sarah said. I took really good care of her. Maybe I just loved her too much.
I don't know. It didn't sound like you loved her too much. It just sounds like maybe, I don't know what happened with that tarantula.
I loved it.
You did love it.
Yes, I did love it.
You and Taya both loved it.
Yes. So unfortunately, that didn't work out that time. But I guess these things happen. I am planning to get a new one.
Yeah.
Using the advice from the Butterfly Pavilion. And then we did a podcast with Cheryl.
Of the Roving Naturalist.
Okay. Fun stuff, and we need to go out to the prairies in Illinois.
Absolutely.
And follow some bison poop.
That is my goal for next summer, I think, for us. We do the bed bug road show. Let's do the bison poo road show next summer.
Okay.
And, yeah. And we'll go collect dung beetles out of bison.
Yeah. You got to hang out with some dung to get some dung beetles, so we'll help Cheryl.
And maybe be in a video with her. She's the roving naturalist. She has her YouTube series. If you haven't checked it out yet, highly recommend it. Very entertaining. Very informative. Yeah, she has a very good camera presence. I like it. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if I'll be that good. I'll just look at poop.
Yeah. We're wild cards. That's what we are, Jody.
True. And then we had like late night. I don't even know what you want to call it. Like it was that we got to talk to the Ask an Entomologist crew. And it was hilarious because we were doing the Facebook Live at the same time, which we have never done.
No.
There's a reason why we don't do video. And then
it's because of my face, isn't it, Jody?
No, it's probably because I can't pay attention. But it was great because we really got to learn a lot about each other too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Scientists as people. But it was so late at night, I'm pretty sure we were like falling asleep near the end.
Towards the end, you and I were definitely very tired. Mike could have kept going, I think. He was kind of the Energizer Bunny that night, but
yeah,
we were definitely ready for a nap.
But it's a fun podcast. I listen to it and I just start laughing because I remember.
It's a lot of interesting stuff. And I think you put it best when you talked about it's people, scientists as people.
Like and Nancy is hilarious.
Yeah.
You know?
Joe's hilarious.
Yeah. Like, so. I wondered about spoons for anyway, you'll have to check that out if you're interested.
And follow Ask an Entomologist on Facebook and on Twitter. And if you ever have bug questions, if you can't get a hold of us, you can always reach out to Ask an Entomologist as well. Yeah, they would help you out.
It's great that we're forming a lot of partnerships and relationships with other entomologists.
That's what it's all about, right? Networking.
Yep. Yes.
So that's sort of what we've been doing today. What we're working up towards is a show all about folklore, insects and arachnids and other arthropods in human folklore. I'm really excited about this topic. It's one that I've wanted to do for a while on Arthropod, but it was one that I felt when I used to do the show alone that if it was just me talking about folklore, like that could get kind of dry, kind of boring. And now it's going to be you and I.
You're never boring.
Well, I don't know. I mean,
you're never boring.
It could have gotten boring. That's what I'll say. So the reason I wanted to talk about this is because I love folklore. I love stories. I love hearing people tell stories. I've always loved hearing tales about the natural world around me that get kind of passed down generation to generation. And so I'm really excited to dive into it. And I wanted to start by having us to discuss, what is folklore, Jody?
Well,
I'm going to put on my NPR voice while we do this.
Well, it's a collection of fictional tales about people or animals. They can be superstitions, confounded beliefs that are important elements are in folklore tradition. So it might not always be. I think as a scientist, sometimes when people come in and they're like, well, I heard this. And you're like, you're good because you always say, tell me more. And I'm like, I don't think so. And then I probably ruin it. But I am open to learning all about arthropod folklore.
Well, and I think that that's why we want to discuss folklore a little bit today, is it does inform a lot of people's opinions about insects and spiders in their home or in their lives. It also can inform a lot of people's decisions pertaining to pest control. So when we talk about pest control, we talk a lot about integrated pest management techniques. That's the Bible that we preach. Mm-hmm. And in integrated pest management, there can be lots of different things, right? Biological control, physical control, all cultural control. And there are some folkloric beliefs around some of those that work. There are some that don't work. Have you gotten the hedge apple question?
That's why I'm rolling my eyes. I had a long hedge apple conversation yesterday in the car with the guy I carpooled with.
So that people think you put hedge apples out in your home.
It works.
And the smell.
It works.
It drives the arthropods away. So there's a big folklore around that. And some people may not do something that would actually help their pest problem because they believe so heavily in this folkloric element of hedge apples.
Tea bags,
peppermints, all that kind of stuff. That builds up over time, and it changes people's opinions of how
orange
they should
peels.
Do. Tell me more about the orange peels.
I know you just put orange peels. It's the citrus.
So you spread garbage around your house, and it makes the pests go away?
Yeah, decomposing organic matter.
Well, I don't know if I buy that one, but they are.
See?
They are. That's
what people, when I say that, I get the look.
Yeah. Well, we're used to getting the look, right?
Right.
Get the look a lot. That quote that you mentioned about folklore is a collection of fictional tales about people or animals, that's from a ThoughtCo.com article we'll put in the show notes. I also went to the American Folklore Society and looked up on their page what they say folklore is. And they say it is the traditional art, literature, knowledge, and practices that are distributed largely through oral communication and behavioral example. So I think you can see where pests and pest control really fit into that, right? Or not even pests, just insects in general. Mm-hmm. You people will tell you about, oh, you shouldn't kill that bug because that's bad luck, or this one is good luck. It's going to rain. Or you watch somebody put out hedge apples, and so you become accustomed to the idea that a hedge apple in your house
Gets passed down.
It does. It definitely gets passed down. And so that's kind of where we're coming at when we discuss this topic with insects. But we also are going to tell some really cool stories that are from many different cultures across the earth. And we're not folklorists. I'm not. I don't think you have a degree in that.
Nope.
It's not one of your 4 degrees, right?
No.
And if we say something that's incorrect about folklore or myth or legend, I hope somebody will let us know, and we'd like to hear about that. But we're going to do our best to treat these stories respectfully, and we're going to do our best to convey them and try to understand some of the science and entomological aspects of them. And the first kind of grouping that I wanted to talk about are, you know, in insects and arachnids, they're omnipresent in our lives. So they're included in a lot of different stories. And some of the stories are really simple things that we can talk about. Some of them pertain to explanations about natural forces that happen around us, like the wind or solar eclipses or rain. And some of them put insects and arachnids, they put them in these sort of grand cosmic roles. And the first story I wanted to share is a creation story from Hopi culture. So Hopi people are native folks from the U.S. And in their culture, they have a story about Spider Woman, who is part of their creation story.
Sounds cool.
Spider Woman. Yeah, I'm all about that. In this story, she's one of the first sort of cosmic beings that comes into existence. So they have their main deity. His name is Tewa, and he has a nephew, Sotuk Nang, and they work together to try and bring life to Earth. And in the story, Sotuk Nang, he creates Spider-Woman. And the first thing that she sort of does after being created is ask, why am I here? What is my role in the universe? Which is sort of an eternal question for a lot of us, right? Mm-hmm. And he points out that her role is to help him to bring life to planet Earth. He points out that Earth is sort of this big molten ball of nothing right now. That it's still being formed and there's nothing alive on it except for them. And he wants to change that. And so she starts molding these twins out of mud. And then she, in the story, she sculpts them out of mud and spit. So the description is something from the mouth, I think is the direct translation. And I thought this was very interesting because it's also described as sort of a silver strand that she drapes over them. So it's the web of a spider. And so in this story, she pulls the web out and drapes it over these twins that she's molded and then sings to them, and the web vibrates and brings them to life. And I thought it was really cool that they describe the web as a liquid that's pulled out and draped over things, because that's what's happening. It's not from her mouth. It's not really spit, but they've got it. They've got a pretty close approximation of silk production in a spider. And these twins, she brings them to life. And I know I'm going to say their names wrong, but they're Pokeng Hoya and Polongo Waya. And these are brought into life to help Spider-Woman to bring more life to planet Earth. So Pokeng Hoya, he is told to help solidify the Earth. And he goes around and kind of touches everything, and he makes the Earth solid. And then his twin, Poloingo Waya, goes around and calls, kind of sings and yells, and produces a sound, a vibration that goes throughout the planet. And this brings sort of reverberation and Tewa to the Earth. So now everything is sort of ringing to his call, to his voice. And then eventually they're both sent to the North and South Pole, respectively, where they help to make the Earth rotate and become stable. And after all of that, the Spider-Woman uses her gifts that we've seen of forming things out of mud and silk in order to produce the animals and plants that live on planet Earth. So I would have to think, in Hopi culture, spiders are not looked down upon like they are in our culture. Would you think that's probably
a good guess? Yeah, I agree. I would think that they would be the creators.
Yeah,
right?
They would be important. It would be looked down upon to kill a spider, probably. And we do see that in some other cultures where a spider web is good luck. Have you ever seen those glass things that go above doors that look like a spider web? It's supposed to look like a web because that brings fortune to the household. And you were talking about a really cool spider web tradition.
When I grew up, I was told if you killed a spider, it was going to rain.
If you killed a spider, it was going to rain.
And that was supposed to be a bad thing because I wasn't rural, so I didn't need the rain too much. But I received this really cool gift last Christmas, and it was this beaded, jeweled kind of little spider. And it sits on my computer monitor at work, but it's supposed to be a Christmas spider, and it's supposed to be an ornament that goes in the tree. And so the story for that, and it came with this little write-up, but it's like the legend of the Christmas spider. And we love spiders, so I think that, you know, so we're a little bit different. But it's a beautiful jewel thing. I would recommend it for anyone who wants a gift. And so maybe the story originated in Germany, but it said a long time ago, a mother was busy cleaning for Christmas. And so the spiders fled to the attic because they wanted to escape the broom. And so when the house got really quiet, the spiders got to creep down and take a peek. And they saw this beautiful Christmas tree. And so in their excitement, they scurried up the tree. And of course, when spiders scurry around, they leave this, this dust or this web. And then when Santa Claus came with gifts for the children, he saw how happy the spiders were. But he knew that the mother would be heartbroken because she had just cleaned everything and she would be upset with these dusty webs. So he ended up turning the webs into silver and gold. And this is the origination of why we use tinsel and we decorate our tree, because evidently every Christmas spider or every Christmas tree should have a spider in its branches. And so I have not put my spider in the tree because I would be heartbroken if it like disappeared. So I just keep it to myself in my office.
I'm a big fan of that particular legend. I have a spider web in my tree. It's a spider web ornament, and it's spray painted silver with silver glitter on it. And it came with the little card that you mentioned that tells you the legend of spider silk in there. So I think that's a beautiful myth or story or folktale. And I like it. It's a little less cosmic than what we talked about with the Hopi one, which I think happens a lot more with insects and spiders. They're not always putting these like, I am the Galactus spider here to change things on a cosmic scale. Sometimes things are a little different. They're just part of a big story. And we have two stories that we wanted to share with you on the show today, two folk tales that we found through some reading. Jody's got one that pertains to dragonflies, and I've got one that pertains to mosquitoes.
Yeah, so this one is a Persian folk tale, and basically it describes a solar eclipse in other ways, I guess. But it's how the dragon ate the sun, because in some cultures, they believe, and if you think about it, if they don't know science, then, you know, this thing happens once every how many years in between, and the sun looks like it's disappearing. I know there was a book when I was a kid, it was like someone's eating the sun. So the story is there was a wise man, and he's probably over 100 years old. He knows this has happened before in his life, but it's going to happen again. And when it happens, it's this fire-breathing dragon that comes in to swallow the sun. And everyone in this village believes him, so they're going to do whatever he says. So he says that even Hercules could not tame this dragon or kill this dragon. Yeah, even Hercules.
Hercules could do almost anything.
So this dragon's like pretty fierce. And when this dragon comes about, a lot of negative things could happen to people's health, and there could be some frightful consequences. So this was a very dreadful time. So this eclipse, like very opposite from what it is now. I mean, think about our eclipse, how excited we were and all the kids. Right. Like this is a dreadful thing. Nobody wants this to happen. So the man told everyone in the village that they needed to make a large cage and find and catch 7 dragonflies to keep in this cage. And during this time, they were supposed to feed these dragonflies water and flies and mosquitoes so that it wouldn't starve. He also had a big horn that he said he would blow when the dragon got closer to the sun, because he knew this dragon was coming to eat the sun. And at this time, he would blow the horn. They were supposed to pray and gather the riverbank, because at this time you do not want to sleep, because sleeping is bad because you might never wake up, which I thought was a very scary part of the story. So what happened is his prediction, of course, came true. He blew the horn, and when the dragon started coming, the people went outside and they started praying, and they started releasing one dragonfly every 7 minutes. And as the dragonflies approached the dragon and the increasing darkness, that frightened the dragon. So the darkness coupled with this dragonfly flying towards him caused him to spit the sun out. So he's basically barfing up the sun. So then they appeared to be completely safe, and the sun was back to normal. So in this village, this story was passed down from generations to generations, because they believe that something is eating the sun and regurgitates it back afterwards.
And that dragonflies can help to save the sun.
Right. So I think it was interesting that a dragon would be afraid of dragonflies.
I do find that interesting as well, but it kind of tracks with a lot of cultural feelings about dragonflies. If you look in Scandinavia and in Europe, they're often called like dragon needles or devil needles.
Yeah, I've heard of them being devil's darners, like sewing needles.
So they look like a needle and they look kind of frightening. And some people even say that witches ride them and things like that. So there is some fear and mysticism surrounding the dragonfly.
Yeah, and they're more kind of the evil. So that's why it was interesting that the spiders in these stories are so positive. The dragonflies are more of a negative.
Right.
Right.
But still a hero.
Yeah.
They saved the sun. I also thought it was very cool that they fed them, and they fed them the right things.
It's true.
My story is a little different. It has less to do with the sun and more with the birth of an entire species of insect, a kind of insect. So in this story, it's called The Mosquito. It's from Vietnam. And in the tale, Nhoc Tam is a modest farmer who married a woman named Nhan Diep. And they were a very young couple that was poor, but in excellent health, and they seemed to be destined to enjoy the happiness of a simple rural life. The husband worked in a rice paddy and cultivated a small field of mulberry trees, while the wife engaged in raising silkworms. So she's making silk and things. But Nyandeep, the wife, she is sort of, she's very prideful at heart. She has bigger aspirations than what life seems to have given her. She is also apparently lazy and dreams of luxury and pleasures that she will never have. But she was clever enough to hide her desires and ambitions from her husband, whose love was genuine, but neither demanding nor discerning. He just figured his wife was cool with doing all this stuff that they were doing in their rural life, and that they would toil diligently throughout their life to ease their poverty and improve their station in life. But suddenly and mysteriously, his wife, Nyandeep, is carried away by death. So she passes away, and he is devastated because he loves her with all his heart. He plunges into this deep sorrow, and he wouldn't leave his wife's body, and he wouldn't let anybody bury it. So he keeps her. And he sells everything he owns. He sells all of his possessions, and he takes a cart and the coffin, and then he goes down to the waterfront, and he buys a boat, and he sails away with her coffin and her and him. He's going to go and try and revive her body. Jody, you have a horrified look on your face. You'd rather just be buried, right?
I'd like to be cremated, but I hope Rodney doesn't travel with my dead body.
Well, wait till you find out what he pulls off here. So what happens is he sails away, and he goes down the river, and one morning he wakes up and he finds himself at the foot of a fragrant green hill, which perfumes the countryside around him. He goes ashore and he sees 1,000 rare flowers and orchards of trees that are laden with varied kinds of fruit. In the orchard, he met an old man who supports himself with a bamboo cane. This man's hair is white as cotton and his face is wrinkled and sunburned. But under his blonde eyelashes, his eyes sparkled like those of a young boy. By this last trait, Nyaktam recognized him as a genie of medicine. So he's a genie. And he traveled throughout the world on his mountain. He actually moves this mountain around. And he teaches people about science of the earth and helps to alleviate their ills. And so Nyaktam throws himself at the genie's feet, and he begs this guy to help him bring his wife back to life. And the genie says, you really shouldn't clean. He can see that this wife of his was really not the person that he perceives her to be. He says, you shouldn't hold on to the things of the earth. You shouldn't cling so tightly to material things and this world. There are other things beyond that you should be concerned with. This world is a snare. You're foolish for wanting to bring her back. And he says, I want to grant your wishes that you bring up, but I fear you will regret it later. And he just can't convince him. The genie can't convince him. So Nyaktam says, I want you to bring my wife back. And he says, okay. So the genie tells him, go to the coffin, open the lid, and cut the tip of your finger. Let 3 drops of blood fall on Nyandeep's body, on his wife's body. As he does it, she opens her eyes slowly and is awakened from a deep sleep, seemingly, and her faculties quickly return. The point here is at this point that the wife is told, you know, you got to be devoted to your husband. You know, you guys need to love each other and be together at this point. And he says, don't forget your obligations to each other. And he says, remember your husband's devotion and in his search to bring you back. May you both be happy for the rest of your days. And so they leave. They're going down the river and they go into this port and they go to sleep, and Nyaktam wakes up and his wife is gone. It turns out that she has gone ashore herself, and she's met the richest guy in this town and now lives with him. And she refuses to leave. He tries to convince her day after day to come back to him, and she won't do it. And finally, after all this, his perception and his love of her is shattered, and he realizes she's not the greatest person in the world. I was wrong. And he says, I don't want anything to do with you. And she says, will you release me from our bonds of matrimony? And he says, I will release you, but all I ask for in return are the 3 drops of blood that I gave you. I want no portion of me to be left with you for the rest of eternity. So, like, he's mad. And so she cuts her finger and lets the 3 drops come out. And each drop that comes out, she shrivels and shrinks a little more until she's shrunken and, like, all deformed, and she's dead again. The magic is gone because the blood dropped out of her. But she is so tenacious and so desperate to be part of the living world that she comes back to life as a mosquito. And this is the birth of mosquitoes. So she chases him for the rest of his days, trying to get back the 3 drops of blood from his body so that she can become a woman again and rejoin the human race. But she's trapped as a mosquito and has since proliferated and made all the mosquitoes that bother us.
And become the biggest killer.
Right.
Of all time.
Right. So we come up with these stories to try and explain.
Your story was way cooler than my story.
I'm sorry. You like that one?
Yeah.
Tell me why you liked it.
Well, because I think it explains things.
You like that
me.
Part
yeah.
of a folklore
Well,
pattern.
Just because I think, well, as an entomologist, I think, well, that's why the females bite, you know,
it's
why it's a blood feeder. And so, yeah, I'm totally into that story. And you're a great storyteller.
Oh, thank you.
Just cut mine out.
No. I also like that one because it's a female, the blood, and she's a female. I thought that was very interesting.
Revenge is always great.
Well, revenge is
great. It's a good story.
Yeah. I can't imagine that they knew that it was only females biting people, but it's
but
a very interesting angle, right?
Yeah. And that she's flying around forever doing that. Like,
right.
Why they're persistent past, like, I don't know. I guess you can, you know, read in whatever you need to from it. But I think that's why there is folklore, right? Like,
yeah.
You can't explain it. Right. And this seems to explain it perfectly to me.
There was another cool mosquito one I read in Gene Kritsky and Ron Cherry's insect mythology book. And it was sort of similar in that it was about mosquitoes and how they came to be. And it was about some Pacific Northwest people who they were getting eaten by this giant and they got tired of it. So they went up the mountain where the giant lived and they built a bear trap and they lured him out of his cave. He's like, rawr, thump, thump, eat the people. And he steps on the bear trap and he falls down in and he's trapped in this big hole in the ground. And they look down on him. And they say, we're here to kill you. We're tired of this reign of terror that you have over us. It's over. We're here to defeat you. And he shouts from the bottom of the hole, you'll never be free of me. I will never leave you alone. You'll never kill me. And they say, watch us. And so they set him on fire. And they burn him for 4 days and 4 nights. And then at the end of this period of burning, they look down in the hole and all that's left is ashes. There's no body. There's no bones. There's no nothing. They've incinerated this giant, and they feel victorious. And so they start to move things around. And just at that moment, this wind comes down into the trap and it blows all of the ashes up into the air. And as soon as they're airborne, they turn into mosquitoes. And now there's all these billions of mosquitoes flying around biting them. So instead of eating them whole, like a piece of bread, they now just suck little droplets of blood. And the giant was proven true that you'll never be rid of me. You'll never kill me. He just became the mosquitoes on the wind. And then they would carve him into their totem poles and stuff, too. There's a cool picture in that book about
it. That is cool.
But that's fun, right? Trying to explain why there's so many of them, why they feed on our blood, all that kind of stuff. That folklore, I think, informs a lot of how people feel about these pests and other insects like dragonflies. And we also build a lot of folklore around them. So those are folk tales, which my understanding is are part of folklore, right?
Yes.
Kind of from what we read through. And folklore can encompass a lot of things, but they're not necessarily a story as much as just something that's kind of passed down. And there's a lot of folklore about insects, and sometimes they discuss them as ill omen bringers, or they might bring you good luck.
Ladybugs. I think one of the – if you talk about bugs, everybody hates bugs, except if they did like a bug, it would be a ladybug.
Right.
And if you ask why – because it brings you good luck.
Right.
It's unlucky to kill a ladybug.
That's true. I would agree with that. You're going to get aphids if you do it. What is another insect that people like a lot?
Well, bees.
They like bees.
There's a lot of stories about bees in like a number of different cultures. There are in Europe, supposedly, and I didn't do this for my wedding, but supposedly if you walk your groom past a beehive, and if he is stung, it symbolizes future infidelity on his behalf. So, like, we should just walk people by beehives all the time.
Wow.
What kind of person are you?
Jody really wants to institute some martial bee law on marriages here. I think that's very cool because it's almost like, did they know that all the bees are female? And like, it's almost like a sister power kind of thing. Like she's telling you, hey, he's not faithful. He's going to cheat on you in the future.
It's true. Well, I mean, bees are very important, right? I mean,
they are important.
Very important. In Britain and Ireland, bees landing on your home, it's a warning that visitors will be coming. And I have a story about this.
Yeah.
This last weekend, I went to go running with a friend, and a bunch of us were going to meet up at his house. And he was talking to something, and I look over, and I was like, what's that? And he was like, oh, it's a bee. It flew in yesterday when we were cleaning, and I just cracked the window open for her, and hopefully she'll warm up, because it's pretty cold out here now in Nebraska,
right.
Warm up and fly back to her home. And
were visiting him.
Yes.
And there was a
bunch of it. Yeah. And so I didn't know this until, you know, recently. So I looked down and there was this little bee, and it was cold, but he had the window open a crack. And so we went for a run. So an hour and a half later, we came back and the bee was gone.
That's awesome.
So it predicted maybe that we were coming and then it went back. But yeah, I definitely like my friend a lot more because he was nice to the bee.
Perhaps some truth in storytelling here.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's true. And there are a bunch of bee folklore,
mm-hmm.
but there's also one. Have you heard of the telling the bees?
You know, I think I have heard of this before. Do you remember Tom Turpin at Purdue?
We used to
have classes
with. Of course.
I remember distinctly him talking about the telling of the bees, and that's how he would say it.
Yeah. I mean,
but what is it?
Well, they're very important. They need to know about the important things that are going on in your life.
Okay.
Because when it comes to, you know, keeping bees, they're very sensitive. And so they'll leave.
Oh, so these are domesticated bees. Like, I don't need to go out and tell the bees that just buzz around on my dandelions things about my life. Like, I don't need to keep them.
I mean, what you tell your bees in your garden is your own prerogative.
But you're talking about a hive of bees.
Right, right.
Okay.
So if, especially, you know, if the beekeeper dies, then the bees need to be told this information because they could desert the hive, or they can stop making honey, or they could die. And as some of your master gardeners will tell you, sometimes, like, the bees have kind of a mind of their own, right? They're nice or not, or producing or not. So it is very important to go to the bees and speak to them politely and tell them the things that are going on.
When I've read about this before, it sounds like they would even sometimes invite the bees to the funeral, and they would let them see the coffin and see the dead body, or they'd give them food and wine from the funeral. And I think that this is just fascinating, that they think these bees are so sensitive, and they make them part of the family so much that they would invite them to the funeral to see all this.
I think that's nice.
It's very beautiful. It's very touching. I think that we often associate this, or I've heard it associated the most with the British Isles. It seems like a big deal there in Britain and Ireland, although I am told through the Wikipedia that it happens in many other nations as well. Switzerland is mentioned, as well as the U.S. And that has a lot to do with sort of Aegean folklore, that bees can bridge the natural world and the afterlife. And so maybe not only do you have to let them know because they might stop making honey, but maybe it's so they can go visit their former beekeeper in the afterlife. Like, they can have a little bee party in heaven or purgatory or wherever.
True, true.
Would you party with your bees?
Yeah, I would party with my bees if they wanted to party with me. I'm seeing this other thing too. If a bee lands on your hand, it means money's coming your way.
Nice. Well, they are made of gold, right? Bees, they look like gold. So.
It's true.
Well, so lots of folklore around mm-hmm. bees. And I think we have an article that we can link to in the show notes, right?
Mm-hmm.
A Mental Floss one, and maybe even one from ThoughtCo again, if you wanted to research through that yourself and read through those. The ones that I was looking up were about butterflies and caterpillars, another group of insects that people really enjoy. I have a big butterfly tattoo on my back, right? Like the red dragon tattoo from that movie, except it's a butterfly, a swallowtail. Well, so we've built a lot of folklore around these because we do like butterflies. In Ireland, you can hear talk of butterflies being seen as a soul, that they're actually the embodiment of a person's soul that has escaped their body as they die. This is also sort of a Grecian idea. Butterflies in some writings from ancient Greece are called Psyche, who has a lot to do with the soul. And so there's this idea that they can skip between this world and the next. So I wonder if they think about butterflies and skippers as sort of the same thing. But butterflies can be quick when they fly around. They can dart sometimes, or they can flutter slowly.
Skippers.
And skippers can move really quick. But sometimes we lose sight of the butterfly. And there was this idea that when that happened, they were going between the worlds, that they were a soul that was slipping between dimensions, sort of. And in Ireland in particular, you were never supposed to kill a white butterfly because it was the soul of a child. And so that seems pretty dubious, because I used to kill a lot of cabbage white butterflies as a kid. And I've done that a lot for 4-H'ers and stuff too. So hopefully that's not true. Otherwise, I'll feel really bad in the afterlife. Some other butterfly folklore from here in the U.S. is if you go to the Appalachians, you can find a lot of fritillary butterflies. And there are tales that if you can catch the fritillary butterfly without damaging its wings and rubbing off the spots, if you can count all the spots before you let it go, that'll tell you how much money is headed your way in the near future. That seems like a pretty daunting task, as you know, all that
no
pixie
money
dust.
Is coming my
yeah,
way then.
Yeah, it comes off really easily, so that's no good. You can also go to the Ozarks, another mountainous area, where there's the morning cloak butterfly. Have you ever seen a morning cloak?
I don't think so.
They're a very beautiful kind of – they look drab to some people, but I think they're a really pretty butterfly. And they overwinter as a caterpillar, so they're often one of the first butterflies we see in spring. And so they're seen as a portent of the coming spring in the Ozarks, which is a biological function, right? Mm-hmm. It seems to track that we would associate those two things together. And I think that we try to do that with a lot of insects. And the big one is usually the woolly bear caterpillar. Have you heard of the legend of the woolly bear?
Yes. Actually, the first time I heard of that, I was running around Lake Cunningham.
Okay.
And there's always woolly bears. Well, it seems like when the woolly bears are out, there's tons of them, and they're all, you know, walking across your path. And someone said, hey, is it really true that the woolly bear will determine whether it's, you know, going to be a long winter? Is it the long winter?
Yeah. How long or how bad the winter will be.
Right.
So a woolly bear, it's a caterpillar that turns into a moth. And as a caterpillar, they have 13 distinct segments that can be rusty brown or black. And according to the legend, this fuzzy worm, this woolly worm, you can use it to read the coming winter. So the wider the rusty brown section, or the more brown segments, the wider that is, or the more brown segments there are, the milder the winter will be. Brown equals nice winter. The more black there is, the more severe the winter. Black, bad winter. Not good. Don't want that. What do you think about this?
Well, I'm making a face because I think it's almost like, I don't know what, like, I'm okay. What about this one?
I don't know. You have to compare it to another.
Right. Yeah. So it's a little bit subjective in a way,
right? I would say very much
like,
so.
Is that a lot? Is this a mild winter or not?
I don't know. There has been some research into this. There are some scientists that have tried to figure out if this is true. If you go to the Old Farmer's Almanac, you can read through some of the history of the woolly bear's transition into this weather predictor. And it talks about Dr. C.H. Curran, who was the curator of insects at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. He would go and look at woolly bears, and over about 8 years, he would measure the segments, he and his wife together, and they tried to put together a data set to see if this was supported. And he said that it worked sort of okay. It was like just as good as a meteorologist is kind of what he concluded. But he unwittingly, I think, created this idea that it's true and that he validated it and then therefore validated a lot of folklore. So not the greatest thing in the world. There have been some more modern research studies that pretty much put the kibosh on this and say there is no correlation between the woolly bear and winter. And I think that that's probably for the best. I would hate to have to trust the woolly bear to tell me how the winter is going to be. But I also wonder if there isn't some sort of nugget of truth to these kinds of things. Like, where did this come from? How did this begin? Was there at some point some sort of nugget of truth to this? Or what would it be? Like, what would make a summer different that the coming winter would be bad? Like, would there be less of a certain food resource, and so they wouldn't get as so much orange in their fur? Like, what is it that could do that? What would cause more melanin in their hair, I guess? I don't know. I think that that's kind of an interesting question.
Right. And there was a little piece here about an entomologist from the University of Massachusetts. And they said, well, there's evidence that the number of brown hairs has to do with the age of the caterpillar.
Ooh.
And so, you know, that could, it can also be different because, you know, we know that insects, the rate of development has to do with temperature.
True.
And degree days.
So if winter is coming and you have to pupate and you weren't quite ready, you could have less hair is what they're saying?
Well, then that would mean it's a predictor of the previous year, not a predictor of the future. Right? So, I mean, there's probably scientific reasons why the woolly bear looks the way it does and why the band looks bigger.
Right.
But that's probably not going to predict the future.
Yeah. And that's all we have to say about that.
But they are very cute.
They are adorable.
I mean, a lot of times as larvae, we can't identify species, but the woolly bear is pretty easy to spot.
Nobody likes the adult form, but I think it's a pretty moth. The Isabella.
Isabella.
Yeah. I think it's nice. So that's kind of some just general introduction to insect folklore around the world. We hope you've enjoyed it. I think that it's a lot of fun to talk about and try and figure out if there is any scientific validity to any of this, or if it's informed some of our thoughts and our actions as modern people. I just think it's a lot of fun to discuss, and I hope you've enjoyed hearing us talk about it. This was a little bit longer of a show, but I think that that's okay. We told some stories and acted them out. You couldn't see us, but we were pretending to be giants and mosquitoes and stuff like that. And we hope that you will tell everybody to come and listen to us tell stories here on this episode of Arthropod. Do you have anything else you want to talk about today, Jody?
Not really.
Covered it all?
Yeah, we'll save it for another
podcast. Yeah, another exciting episode here in a week or two. We'll probably have a holiday break coming up here shortly, but we will be back with ever more content, all kinds of bug-related stuff. If you want to find us on the web, you can always go to our blog at arthro-pod.blogspot.com. All of our shows are housed there. You can go back and listen to old episodes. Send us an email. Find us on there and give us a comment. If you find us on iTunes or Stitcher or whatever podcatcher app you use, leave us a review. We always appreciate seeing those kinds of things pop up in our email because it makes us feel better sometimes on bad days. And you can always find us on Twitter if you wanted to talk to us. I am at @JLarson_UNL.
And I am at @JodyBugsMeUNL.
And we would be happy to hear ideas for future shows or just talk to you about why we think the woolly bear is adorable.
Or if you want to talk to us.
Yeah, or if you just want to have fun with us. Yeah, if you want to be on a show, let us know if you want to be a potential guest in the future. With that, thanks for tuning in, and we will see you in the future on another exciting episode of Arthropod.
Cue the music.